Hey there, listeners. Vermont Edition co-host Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you're about to listen to has been edited and condensed for clarity and brevity. Enjoy. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Vermont's sole seat in the U.S. House of Representatives is up for grabs this fall. Congressman Peter Welch, who currently holds the seat, is running for the Senate as longtime Senator Patrick Leahy heads into retirement. Here at Vermont Edition, we are interviewing all the candidates for the House and Senate seats, and you can find the interviews we've already done on vpr.org. Today, we are joined by a Democratic candidate for the House, Dr. Lewis Myers. He is a physician practicing in Rutland and a former probation officer. Dr. Myers, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Ms. Lafrac. I'm really honored to be here and talking to you and the VPR listeners.
Well, let's start with the question we are asking all candidates for this seat. Why do you want to run for Vermont's seat in the U.S. House?
Well, it's a fundamental question, isn't it? I would give two answers, one philosophical, one political. In terms of the philosophical, I spent my adult life, entire adult life, in the helping professions, first as a social worker and probation officer, and then went to medical school, and for the last 29 years have been a physician in primary care and hospital medicine. So the focus there is on saving lives, is on helping people through some of the worst moments of their lives and their families as well. And I think that I see serving in Congress as certainly different than that, but yet connected in the sense that if you sponsor or co-sponsor legislation, instead of helping one person at a time, you could potentially be helping thousands or even millions of people in this country or overseas. And I think so you can have a huge impact. And I think that is one of the reasons that I would like to try and serve in Congress. From a political standpoint, I was actually the last of the Democratic candidates to begin my campaign. That was about 2.5 months ago. When I looked at the other four candidates, all of whom, by the way, are really nice people, but they're all, I would characterize them on the progressive end of the spectrum in the Democratic Party. I consider myself a moderate Democrat, or I would prefer to use the term realistic Democrat. And I think that I thought it was important that voices like mine or diverse voices could be heard in this election. When I was going door to door to get the signatures to be on the ballot, you know, and talking to people over the last 2 months, and I would tell them I was a moderate Democrat, so many people expressed relief that there was someone who was sort of a moderate in the race. Because I think they're out there. I think that whether it's the media or social media, that, you know, always the loudest voices are heard, and those tend to be on the far left or the far right. But I think there are a lot of people in Vermont who consider themselves more in the middle. And frankly, I think that's why Phil Scott continues to be elected every 2 years by overwhelming margins. He's not being elected by the far right or the far left. He's being elected by all the people in the middle.
Well, Dr. Myers, you brought up this idea of how you might represent diverse voices if elected to Congress. Now, Vermont is the only state in the U.S. to never have elected a woman to Congress, and it's also never elected a person of color to Congress. Now, the other four Democratic candidates are women, two are women of color. And as a white man yourself, I'm curious what you would say to people who are listening to this program and might wonder why you're entering the race at a time when Vermont is potentially poised to diversify its pool of elected officials for the first time ever.
Sure. And, you know, I know that has been a big issue or talking issue. Some of it, frankly, I think coming from the media as much as from the public. I understand completely that many women would like to see someone, another woman, go to Washington. I think that's true for any group, whether it's ethnic, racial, religious group. It's always a certain sense of pride to see someone from your group represent the general public. So I understand that completely. The two things I would say about that are this. First of all, when you sort of limit yourself in that way, you're actually excluding, in this case, 50% of Vermonters from running for the House, if you assume it's going to be a woman that's elected. And I know that there are a lot of capable men out there who have served in government in Vermont or in other important positions who would have been very capable of running for Congress. I think they got scared off, frankly, by this groundswell of opinion that it has to be a woman this year. Perhaps I don't scare quite so easily, but I think that limiting ourselves is sometimes not a good thing to do. I think we need more people running, perhaps not less. The other thing I would say is, and I have this experience from being in the medical profession as well, to have to be careful about associating a gender with how someone's going to vote. And for our Democratic listeners, I would just throw out some names. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Congresswoman in South, in I believe it's in Georgia. She is a woman. Lorraine Boebert, the gun-toting Congresswoman from Colorado, is a woman. Marsha Blackburn, very conservative Republican senator from Tennessee, is a woman. And there are hundreds of women right now across the country running for either the House, the Senate, or down ballot positions who are still running on the platform that the election was stolen, that Donald Trump is still the legitimate president of the United States. So, you know, these are women. And if you just voted for them because they're a woman, you might be somewhat disappointed at the result. And finally, I would say from my own experience in medicine, almost 30 years now in healthcare, that it's you hear a lot that women are, because they're women, are going to be more empathetic and caring and better doctors. And, you know, the reality is that's not true. I have met some wonderful women colleagues who are totally empathetic and caring. And then I've met some that are anything but. And the same holds true for men. I've met, you know, there are a number of male physicians I've met who are somewhat harsh. And then there are others who are some of the loveliest human beings I've ever met. So I think you have to look at the person. And particularly this year, when you look at the kind of problems that our country is facing, that the world is facing, just tremendous problems. I think it's probably more important to look and see, is that person going to represent your beliefs in terms of their voting and their stances, rather than simply their gender?
Well, Dr. Myers, you brought up your professional history as a physician. Now, you've pledged to use your experience in the healthcare system to work on making necessary improvements step by step, as I believe you have on your campaign website, to the healthcare system if you're elected to Congress. So what are some of those necessary improvements as you see them? And what would step one look like to improving healthcare in the U.S.?
Well, thank you for the question. We have a tremendous healthcare system in terms of the research, in terms of the clinical treatments that we can offer in this country. Obviously, there are great disparities, economic, racial disparities, and who receives care and the care they receive. The system is far too expensive, whether it's medications or other treatments. I'm not going to Washington, though, to tear down the system. As I mentioned on my website, I would be going step by step. I think there are some ways that we can intervene that will make people's lives better, that would have enough bipartisan support. Remember, there are actually an increasing number of physicians and other healthcare providers who now serve in Congress. I think probably more of them are on the Republican side than the Democrat side, but nevertheless, they come from a shared background of taking care of people medically. I could use one example that's already been done last year. I don't know if many people are aware of this, but there was a bill to eliminate that passed, to eliminate surprise billing. And this is where people go to the hospital or go take an air ambulance and are told that their insurance company covers their services in the hospital. And then they find out later that one of the groups, for example, an ER group or the providers or radiology or et cetera, are private contractors, and they don't have to go through the usual insurance, and they can bill well over and above the insurance. So people get these huge bills. Well, Congress finally put an end to that. And I think that that has made a difference. It won't change the whole system, but it certainly has made a difference in thousands of people's lives every year. There are, I think, in the realm of medication, I think there's a great agreement that medications are too expensive, that the pharmaceutical companies are gaming the system. Obviously, Big Pharma is a very powerful lobby in Washington, but I think there's enough dissatisfaction in the country, both among Democrats and Republicans, that we can make some progress on this. President Biden has recommended capping the price of insulin at $35 a month. I think that's a that's an important step, but we can do even better than that. You know, Medicare is able to negotiate prices with providers in the and with hospitals, and it's sort of antiquated to think that they are not able to negotiate any prices with pharmaceutical companies. So I think that that's a step that will happen, and I hope that it happens soon.
Well, Dr. Myers, I want to jump in here to make sure that we have time to hit on some other key topics that are important to Vermonters in this election. Let's talk here about affordable housing, one of the main issues facing Vermonters today. What would you do as a congressperson to address Vermont's critical housing shortage?
Well, this is a huge problem, as we know, and obviously it's not limited to Vermont. I think practically every state in the country now is facing affordable housing issues, even states even more rural and larger than Vermont. I mean, there are a number of reasons for it. So I'm not sure any particular cure is going to be the cure-all. Part of it, obviously, is the pandemic limiting some of the supplies of material. Some of it is general inflation driving up the cost of workers and labor. A lot of it comes down to zoning in many communities, and these are state and local community issues in terms of restrictions on where and what kind of housing can be built. The short-term rentals, Airbnbs and other such businesses have taken a lot of rental housing, long-term rental housing off the market. Certainly, I think from a federal standpoint, expanding Section 8, which is the housing vouchers for low-income people, that has not really been increased in decades, I think. And the waiting list is years and years and years. You could be looking at a 10 or 15 year wait to get a voucher 8, a Section 8 voucher. So I think expanding that, you know, the Federal Reserve is going to have some input. Of course, Congress doesn't influence the Federal Reserve, or is not supposed to, but interest rates have some effect on the ability of people to buy housing. Supporting people who are getting into their first house is the critical aspect, because once you're in, unless it's once you're in, generally the equity begins to increase. Now, we've seen obviously in 2008 that that doesn't always hold true, but if the loans are good loans to people who are going to be steadily working, then at least getting people into their first house is a big step forward.
Now, Dr. Myers, for listeners who haven't been following your career, I want to just add a bit about your backstory here. Now, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, you moved to Vermont about a decade ago and ran in 2016 as an independent for lieutenant governor before dropping that effort and running the same year as a Democrat for a state Senate seat in Chittenden County, which you did again in 2018 and 2020. Now, I'm curious what you have done in the ensuing years to educate yourself about the issues facing Vermonters all around the state, and particularly outside of Chittenden County, where you reside, that makes you feel ready to represent the entire state in Congress without having been elected to a local seat in the state government.
Right. Well, no, thank you for asking that. Just the process of running for office is helpful, because you talk to and meet with any number of people, both elected officials, appointed officials, and talking to people door to door. I've met thousands and thousands of people, hearing their concerns. I think that working in Rutland, and I've been down there at Rutland Regional now for 9 years, has been very, very helpful, because I think if you just live in Chittenden County, you can get a skewed impression of Vermont. And I spend, you know, nearly half my life in Rutland. And Rutland is, as you know, is a hardworking town. There are a lot of people down there struggling just to get by. You don't see the huge million-dollar homes in Rutland that you see in Chittenden County sprouting up everywhere. They obviously have had a serious drug problem down there, an alcohol problem, as other parts of Vermont. So I think it has given me a much broader picture of Vermont and the struggles that people have. In terms of not having been elected official, you know, it's a plus minus in a way. There are a lot of people that go to Congress who've never served in office. I don't know the percentages, but I think it's quite a significant number of first-term congressmen who've never been elected before. So they come from different backgrounds. And I think my background of being in healthcare, working with all sorts of different people, both in terms of the staff and taking care of people and making life and death decisions on an almost daily basis, will serve me well in terms of putting things in perspective when I have to make very important life and death decisions and life and death votes in Congress.
Well, Dr. Myers, before we let you go, I want to ask you about climate change. Now, at a Castleton University candidate forum last month, you were asked about climate change, which obviously is one of the most difficult issues facing the country and the planet today. And there you talked about the need to rely on nuclear power to meet climate and emissions goals. Now, how realistic is nuclear power given that industry's chronic inability to bring in projects on time or on budget?
Well, I did bring up nuclear power, and I think I'm the only Democratic candidate probably who supports it as part of the overall. It's obviously not going to be the overall answer in our country or in any country. But I get concerned when you look at countries around the world, such as Germany or even Japan, who have eliminated nuclear power and now are facing terrible energy shortfalls. In Germany's case, they've had to rely on Russia for so long, and Japan has its problems as well. It's multifaceted. It's a huge problem, but I do think nuclear power will need to be part of the answer. It's an absolutely clean source of energy. The new nuclear reactors that are being built in Europe are smaller. They're less expensive. They do come online quicker. You're correct that it won't be tomorrow that they come online, but a lot of the solutions that we're looking at are going to be solutions into the future. So I do support nuclear power as part of the picture.
Dr. Lewis Myers is a candidate for the Democratic nomination to the U.S. House of Representatives. Dr. Myers, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you.